Hello, lovely listeners. Welcome back to another episode of Coffee and Crime, a true crime podcast. If you're new here, hi, hello, how you doing? My name is Lisa Marie, and each week I sit down with a cup of coffee and I tell you all a true crime story. First off, happy Easter, everyone. I hope that the Easter bunny bounced his way to your house, hid the eggs well for a good old-fashioned Easter egg hunt, or if that's not what you're into, I just hope that your weekend's been full of chocolatey goodies and other sweet treats. If you hold this weekend in a religious context, if this is important to you for religious reasons, I hope you had a very peaceful and very good long weekend celebrating Easter and what that means for you in your religious context. For me, as a Roman Catholic, it is the most important time of our calendar. So it's been a very, very busy week, very full on, but it's been very special. So I hope it has been for you too. Before we get into this week's case, I have to go over a few little admin things, so bear with. You would have noticed there was no little musical interlude at the beginning of this episode, as there usually is. That's because everything has gone horribly wrong. The laptop I usually record on has decided to go kaput again. It's not connecting to the internet. I don't know what's wrong with it. It's very old. I probably just need a new one. So I'm back to recording on a different device, and it's giving episode one vibes because I have to do it the same way I recorded my first ever episode. So we love that. We love that. Another quick plug just to remind you all about the giveaway that's live. Check out Instagram for all the details. There's going to be three names drawn to win some goodies. There's heaps of ways to get entries. And you can also get involved if you aren't on Instagram by commenting the word giveaway in the Q&A box underneath the Spotify episode, the previous two, and all of the episodes up until May 21st, which is when the draw will be done, because that is Coffee and Crime's 1 year podiversary. Whoop, whoop, whoop. Another exciting thing to talk about, I've got some shout outs to do. I love doing that. These are a couple of people that I've been able to meet virtually over the last couple of weeks. The first person is at Organizing Drunk Squirrels, which I think is a brilliant name. It's been so lovely talking to them. They also bought me a coffee on my Buy Me a Coffee link. So thank you. Like, that's so nice. They also got dibs on a case recommendation, which they delivered. So I can't wait to bring that one to you all. But we are actually about to get into a little bit of a series. So it will be coming out after the series is done. Another quick reminder that the link to Buy Me a Coffee is in my bio, and it's just nice to donate through there. It does help the podcast. Plus, you get priority on cases, so why not? Also, a shout out to Michelle Curtin, all the way from Ireland. She sent me a very lovely message this week, just touching in, saying she's listening and where she's from. So it's been really lovely talking to her. And also, my final shout out to Pocket DJ, host of Coffee Chats at Coffee Fitness Unicorn, which again, brilliant name. I'm not this creative with any of my handles on any of my socials. So thank you all so much for reaching out and connecting with me. I love conversing with you guys. And if you're listening, just message me. Like, I don't bite. Just come and say hey. Just say hi. All right, I think that's all my admin things. Yes, we are going to get right into this. It is time, lovely listeners, for another serial killer episode. And oh my gosh, have I got a really awful dude for you. You know his name by the title of this episode, but to be honest, I've not seen a lot of podcasts covering this guy, and I have a theory as to why. His story is very complicated. He's essentially a serial killer who has been shown a lot of empathy, which is crazy, right? Carl Panzram, who we are covering today, his story brings a conundrum because he's evil. He's awful and he's horrible, like, no doubt about that. But he is also the product of an abusive childhood, as most of them are, and we always say we feel sorry for them when they're younger, not when they're older. But he's also the product of poor prison conditions, maltreatment, and torturous punishments. And there were actually a lot of activist groups form because of Carl Panzram and his treatment in jail. Even though he did some really awful things to be put there, he was also treated really, really badly. It's a weird story, and it sends you in a bit of a spin when you hear it. You tend to forget how evil he is because of all the things that happens to him. But then you talk about his evil things and you're like, oh yeah, well, you know, okay. Like, it's crazy. But there is a lot to cover, and this will be a multi-part series, because fun fact, when I start researching a case, what I like to do is I might listen to a few podcasts or watch a few docos, videos, read a few things, but I'll just jot down like a timeline, a very basic timeline, key events, key dates, a basic understanding of what happened, and then I'll go back through with more resources, I'll do cross-referencing, fact-checking as much as possible, and then fleshing out that timeline. The skeleton timeline for Carl Panzram was 11 pages long, and that was before any kind of deep diving, so we have a lot, okay? In this week's episode, we are going to start right at the beginning and meet Carl. We're going to learn about his family, his background, his environmental situation, as well as looking into his early life of crime, his first couple of imprisonments, and the treatment he received. We will see some escalated criminal activity, a few escape attempts, but then next week is when we'll look at the peak of his criminal career, so to speak. We'll also look at a few more prison sentences and his treatment there, up until, spoiler alert, his death. Now, depending on the length of part two, if it does start getting a bit too long, I'll do a third part, but it'll be shorter and dedicated to the psychology and aftermath of Carl Panzram in terms of prison reform and treatment. So that's kind of the guideline I'm thinking. Bear in mind it may change, but yes. So without further ado, lovely listeners of Coffee and Crime, grab your cup of coffee or whatever caffeinated beverage you need to get through your day. I'm having a stiff drink because I want to put my fist through a wall because of everything going wrong. But don't be like me. Grab a cup of coffee. Hold on to it tight because we are in for a ride today. And join me as I bring you the story of Carl Panzram. Warning, the following episode contains adult language, discussion on arson, animal abuse, child abuse, torture, sodomy, rape, and murder that listeners may find disturbing. This podcast is recommended for listeners 16 years and above. Listener discretion is advised. So, to give you a little taste of what we're dealing with here, I'm going to read you a quote from Carl himself. I'll explain, it'll probably come in part two, where this quote is from and how we have it. But here is a little teaser about the guy we're dealing with today. Quote, "In my lifetime, I have murdered 21 human beings. I have committed thousands of burglaries, robberies, larcenies, arsons, and last but not least, I have committed sodomy on more than 1,000 male human beings. For all of these things, I am not the least bit sorry." End quote. Whew. So let us meet the monster and where it all began. Carl Panzram was born Charles Panzram on June 28, 1891, in East Grand Forks, Minnesota, to Prussian immigrant parents Johann and Matilda Panzram, more commonly known as John and Lizzie. Now, I don't know if Carl was a nickname from Charles given to him as his parents. I don't know where Carl actually started coming into play, but I'm just going to call him Carl because that's what he's known as. East Grand Forks, Minnesota, back in the 1890s, was a very small community with a population of 795 people. And by the sounds of it, it was just a whole lot of field next to a whole lot of river. Something must have happened in the last 10 years of the 1800s, because in the census of 1900, it showed that the population had jumped from 795 people to 2,077 people. Possibly a surge of other German and Prussian immigrants to the area, seeing as East Grand Forks is right on the border of Minnesota and North Dakota, and as we learned back in the episode about the Wolf Family Massacre, around this time those areas were mainly settled by immigrant families. Now, Johann Panzram was a veteran, but he was a mean man. He was violent, had a short temper. He did work really hard on the farmland that he was given upon immigrating, even though he had no farming experience, but he was just not a nice dude. Matilda, his wife, was the obedient housewife, but she was also very stern and very strict as well. Matilda had grown up in a strict Lutheran family, and she carried on her religion into her adult life and raised their children Lutheran as well. Now, Johann and Matilda were dirt farmers, and this practically meant they were working on an infertile piece of land trying to grow anything, but only to be disappointed every harvest season when there was barely enough to feed the family, let alone sell to any markets. Then there was the Panic of 1893, which lasted until 1897, an economic depression that was caused by the collapsing of the Philadelphia and Reading Railroad Company and the National Cordage Company. It was like the Great Depression before the even more greater depression in the 1930s, just making the poor even more so. Now, I just mentioned that Johann and Matilda had some kids. There are 6 known Panzram children, because there were some sources that said there was actually 8 of them, but also indicated that a couple of them had died, unfortunately. But there were 6 known Panzram children, but they weren't born to be loving members of a family. They were bred to be workers. This was a very common thing in poor farming families. You don't have kids out of love. You need free labor to be done on the farm. Now, our mate Carl was the youngest after big brothers John Paul, August, Albert, Louis, and his twin, the only sister, Louise. And then it was Carl. So those are the 6 known Panzram children. Carl described his family as such, quote, hardworking, ignorant, and poor, all except myself. I have been a human animal since I was born, end quote. Needless to say, things in the Panzram household were not pleasant. Johann was very threatening, and he was mean, and this would be the only way to keep all of his boys in line. He was abusive towards Matilda, and in turn she would take it out on the kids. Just a very rough place to be. Add that on top of working on an infertile piece of land without there being much food. It wasn't very healthy for these kids to be growing up in this environment. Now, the state of Minnesota did mandate that all children had to attend school from the age of 5, but this did not decrease the hours of work on the farm that they did. Instead, the working hours cut into their sleep time, and Carl recalled that his sleep time was sliced down to at least 2 hours a night, being woken up in the cold early hours of the morning to do work before going to school, then coming back home to work some more. Needless to say, the exhaustion took its toll on Carl's health, surely his siblings as well, but we're just here to talk about Carl today. Carl was constantly blank-eyed, almost zombie-like, and by the time he was 7 years old, he was described as a dead man walking. At 7, man, that's the time you're like running around, you're getting outside and getting dirty, you're figuring things out, like, and he already looks like he should be close to retiring. Oh, it's just, I can't imagine it. Carl also developed severe earaches, a racking cough, along with many other ailments, but his family could never afford to take him to the doctor or the hospital, so Carr was forced to work through it. Now, the farm itself was going into turmoil. It wasn't growing anything. It wasn't producing anything. It was a sinking ship. And John Paul, the eldest Panzram child, he left to seek assistance from distant relatives, but had absolutely no intention on returning. He was like, I'm out. I'm out of here. And now having the eldest and strongest worker on the farm leave, it wasn't too long after that Johann, Papa Panzram, also up and left Matilda and the rest of the kids around 1899, when Carl was around 7-8 years old. Again, not long after that, August, the second oldest child, he also jumped ship too. Now, Matilda had hoped for more support from her children since she had raised them, but because she raised them without love, there was no loyalty, there was no sentiment for their mother. Now, Matilda was able to sell large sections of their land to keep the house from being repossessed from the bank, but it just wasn't enough. She started to also suffer with high blood pressure and dizzy spells, so things were really taking a toll. Albert, the third child, who is now the eldest on the farm, he quit school to help his mother out with the physical labour during the daytimes, as she was just not able to. She wasn't well, and it was really, really hard. Louis, Louise, and Carl would help out after school, but it was Albert who took the role of the enforcer of discipline, since he was now the man of the house, and he was really, really tough on the younger Panzram children to do better. There was plenty of work to be done and plenty of beatings to be hashed out if someone said or looked at Albert the wrong way. Albert was very intimidating, just like his father, really. Albert stood at over 6'4". He was a big boy. He was rough, raw-boned, and hot-headed. And it seemed that Carl, being the youngest, sounds like he was a bit of a cheeky shit, Carl got the brunt of it. In 1900, after the end of the Panic of 1983, East Grand Forks did seem to become a town of some wealth. Keyword is some. Not for the Panzrams, however. They were still poorer than poor. At 8 years old, Carl would often go for walks around town and wonder why some people just had everything they wanted and needed, but there were some people who had nothing. Carl became bitter and angry at his family for being poor. He started misbehaving at school and was often spanked. He purposefully disobeyed Albert at home and just became a menace. Carl also began to raid his father's liquor supply, and he would drink himself to sleep, since sleep was so short in the house. But once Carl had made his way through that, he would start visiting bars around town, where patrons would give him sips of a drink for a laugh. Until one night, still at 8 years old, Carl was able to swindle more than just a few sips, and he was caught by the police brawling other young boys. But once they realized that Carl was out of his mind drunk, he was charged for public intoxication by a judge at a municipal court. I don't know exactly what the sentence was. I didn't think he got a sentence. I think Matilda was given a fine, but I couldn't find the exact details about that. Carl was released back into her care, which we know by now wasn't very caring at all. Carl was beaten up by Albert for being an inconvenience. During his ninth year, Carl's earaches only got worse until the point he developed a very severe case of mastoiditis, which is an infection on the mastoid bone on the skull behind the ear. This had caused Carl's ear to swell so bad that he became deaf on one side and he was not able to walk straight since it affected his balance. Now, even though he was not in a loving household, Matilda knew he couldn't go on like this. But since she had no money for a surgery, Carl underwent a tabletop operation, aptly named because it was done on the top of the table in the kitchen of his home, and his mother operated on his ear, I say in quotation marks. as Carl lay on the table with Albert, Lewis, and Louise literally lying on top of him to hold him still, Matilda took a small knife and made an incision behind his left ear. Now, luckily, Carl's weak and helpless body passed out from the pain as Matilda made the cut, but he was abruptly woken up by having near boiling hot water poured on his open wound to clear out the infection, because that's how it works, right? This pain sent Carl right off the table. Like, he was leaping off, screaming at the top of his lungs. It didn't matter that his 6'4" brother Albert was pinning him down. And as Albert tried to grab Carl again, Carl punched him right in the face. And from this point on, Carl was constantly wild and violent. So let's just take a pause. Three guesses as to what happened when the very inexperienced Matilda made a cut on Carl's head and was poking and prodding around in there. Say it again for the people in the back. Head trauma, very likely to suffer some damage to the left side of his temporal lobe in the brain. Brain injury, brain damage, yeah, you got it. And as we, as true crime junkies, serial killer nerds, or fanatics of this genre, we know that 9.9 times out of 10, a serial killer suffers some sort of head trauma in their early life. And here we have it, folks. Here we have the head trauma. And on top of that, the incision into the left side of his brain didn't even fix the infection, and the cut spread bacteria further into his brain, and he had no choice but to go to the hospital, where he was laid up for a couple of days. I'm surprised that he didn't die from this, to be honest, because, like, this wasn't sterile. It was literally in the kitchen of a farmhouse. There's probably, like, feces bacteria everywhere. This was probably a knife that Matilda just pulled out the drawer, washed with some water, and wiped down with a cloth. Like, what the fuck? Now, I will note that when Carl was in the hospital, there was no medical records coming out of him suffering any kind of brain damage. But to be honest, who would even know back in 1900? At that time, hospitals were for the gravely ill and dying, so there was no tests. There was no kind of, you know, extra little operations they could have done just to see if he was suffering any brain damage. It was literally just to make you comfortable if you were dying, essentially. So if, and it's a very likely thing to have occurred, if Carl did have damage inflicted, to the temporal lobe, this will affect hearing, decision-making, ability to focus, and it can also cause abrupt and unprovoked aggression. For many months after this botched surgery, Carl was also having discharge coming from his ear. He still had issues with it. It didn't really fix itself, and he continued to suffer on with it. Now, in 1903, at 11 years old, Carl was at the end of his tether. He wanted to experience life away from his family, as he would see others living, quote, nice, easy lives who were not kicked around and worked to death, end quote. So he decided to leave home. Carl would go wandering around the town. He'd get sips of alcohol from patrons at pubs. And after the whole ear debacle, Carl was hardly ever at school. That it got to the point he was just no longer on the registry, like not on the roll for class. And one night he was sitting on a hillside, which overlooked the Panzram farm, but also their closest neighbours, who were considerably more wealthy than them. He was also slightly intoxicated, and 11-year-old Carl decided to break into his neighbor's house. He walked right up to the front door and let himself in since it was unlocked, and he decided he was going to steal items of value. So you may think, all right, he's going to steal some cash and some jewelry that he can sell. No, the items of value that Carl stole was an apple and a slice of cake, which kind of breaks my heart, to be honest. Now, before leaving the house, Carl noticed a revolver in a glass display cabinet. Now, Carl wanted to be many things, right? He wanted to be rich, healthy, not hungry. But above all, Carl wanted to be a cowboy that shot and killed Native Americans like they did in the movies. Not the best influence, but okay. So Carl also stole the revolver and headed out. And then he thought, well, to be a cowboy, he would need to head out west, right? Because that's where they all are, the wild, wild west. So Carl, with apple, cake, and revolver in tow, he headed for the rail yards to catch a freight train. He was promptly found, caught by railway workers, reported to the police, and taken home, where he then thought it would be cool to show off the gun to his brothers, little flex. Check what I've got, boys. But no, Albert ended up beating him to nearly an inch of his life for stealing the gun. The theft was also reported by the neighbors to the police, and they were back at the Panzram farm and knew instantly who had done it, since Carl was already making a name for himself as a troublemaker. So in 1904, he was back in front of the judge at the municipal court, and it was the same judge who had charged him with public intoxication when he was 8, and now he's about 12 years old. The judge sentenced Carl to the Minnesota State Training School, which was a reform school in Red Wing, Minnesota, which is about 6 hours away from East Grand Forks. Carl said about this place, quote, "Right there and then, I began to learn about man's inhumanity to man," end quote. And he's not wrong. This place is just stuff of nightmares. Like, it's so scary and it's terrible. The reform school provided education and training in an effort to reform delinquent boys and girls. It actually wasn't until 1911 that a reform school for girls only was made, but at the time that Carl was there, it was co-ed. It had both genders. Boys were instructed in trades and exercised military drills, and girls were taught sewing, cooking, and other general housework skills. It was for children who received court convictions other than murder. Now, fun fact about this place, it inspired the Bob Dylan song, Walls of Red Wing. And here are just some of the quotes to give you an idea. "It's many a guard that stands around smiling, holding his club like he was a king, hopping to get you behind a wood piling, inside the walls of Red Wing." Oh, this place actually gives me nightmares. Needless to say, when 12-year-old Carl got to the Red Wing, he was not treated well. None of the kids were, to be honest. There were over 250 kids at the time, ranging between 7 and 21 years old. And about 2/3 of the attendees were immigrants who spoke little to no English, and sometimes that was the reason they were in there, because they weren't speaking English. Well, that makes no sense. Now, similar to prison, when Carl arrived, he had to have a full inspection, like a really invasive inspection. Carl was stripped to make sure he hadn't got any weapons tied to his body or taped to his body or whatever, and the warden was all up in Carl's business, looking for any, quote, "signs of sinning," end quote. The warden then questioned Carl if he had any homosexual tendencies. Now, Carl had never even heard this word before, but the warden thought it was his place to give Carl a full rundown by describing what a predatory homosexual would do to him. Like, full details. Which makes me think that this warden is projecting and is probably a predatory homosexual himself. He's a slimeball. We don't like the warden. I get that they want to make sure the kids aren't bringing any weapons in, but there's a difference between checking for weapons and deciding to give the birds and the bees talk, essentially, in a very violent and very awful way to a child who hasn't even heard the word homosexual before. You know what I mean? Like, it's not necessary. Carl was shocked into silence, and maybe this is what the warden wanted. I don't know, guys, the olden days and this time and this reform school, it's so fucked. It's pretty fucked. Carl had no intentions of making any friends, and he probably had a mean resting bitch face because none of the other kids tried to be his friend. The next morning, Carl was taken to a place where he learnt what really happened at a reform school. Before the sun rose, Carl was woken up and walked right to the edge of the property to a wooden warehouse, which was named by the students as the painting room. Not because it was some arts and craft lovely little playroom, but it was where the kids would come out having their bodies painted black and blue. The intention of bringing new arrivals to the reform school to the painting room was to shock them out of their old behaviour and give them a very clear indication of the treatment they would receive if they stepped out of line. Carl and others who were taken to the painting room were stripped, fastened down onto a bench face down, had a towel soaked in salt water laid on their backs, and they were whipped with a belt that was made by the warden's design. It was broad and had holes like a normal belt, but the holes would pinch the skin and create blisters, and then the blisters would be popped once their back was struck again, and the salt water would sting the open wound. Like, it's fucking disgusting. Who thinks ever that it's okay to do this to kids, man? Like, I get the whole wanting to shock the bad behavior out, but holy shit, man, that's evil. Carl realized that the warden took sick pleasure watching this happen, and every time he cried out in pain, it was more enjoyable for the warden. So Carl actually quickly learned to stop crying out. He would grit his teeth and bear it, which obviously made the whipper, I don't think that's the correct term for it, but the whipper try even harder. Carl did also claim to be sexually assaulted and raped by the staff during many of his visits to the painting room, and even though this is all being claimed and there's no evidence to support it, I think it's safe to say it probably did happen. You know, we're hearing now of all these orphanage, foster homes, reform schools that have a history of, you know, sexually assaulted victims, and it's so terrible. So even though there's no evidence of it, and Carl turns out to be a really fucking evil person who nobody really wants to listen to, I would venture to say that this is true. Now, even though the intent was to beat out the bad behavior, it had very much the opposite effect on Carl. He said, quote, "The more they beat me and whipped me, the more I hated them and their damn religion," end quote. Because when the kids weren't getting beaten and abused, they had to go to class. It is a school, after all. They had Bible lessons, prayer times, hymn practice, and then work assignments, school class, military skills like that. Carl had no interest whatsoever in learning about faith and God, and this would cause him to play up in class. He would blaspheme, he'd cause a scene and a riot in the classroom, so he was constantly taken out to the painting room for punishment. So, like I just said, after class they'd have work assignments or skills class, military-like drills to do, something along those lines. But Carl was more often than not just trying to get into trouble because he felt like being defiant and challenging the rules. He got offences for all sorts of things. And to be fair, some of these things like wouldn't even be considered things today. Like, they were just wanting to punish him. He would be getting offences for things like not being able to fold a napkin properly. Look, it's a fucking napkin. But then there were some offences that, yes, okay, needed punishment for sure, but just not to the extreme that he endured. Like, Carl was caught for stealing, which, yes, stealing is bad. That does need correcting. He also attempted to escape and was caught, which again, yes, it's good, it's not good. He's escaping because it's evil there. It's not good because he's there really to reform. and he was punished for that. And again, yes, punish appropriately, not fucking torture these kids, because that's what was happening. Each time at the paint shop, it would consist of at least 25 to 30 whips, more if the offense was worse. But no matter what no matter what the guards did to Carl, they couldn't break him. And more often than not, his sessions in the painting room ended because the guards grew tired of whipping him. What is surprising is that Carl was constantly in the painting room, right? So his wounds would never heal completely. So the fact that he never got sick with an infection or anything like that is like, what? Regular showers were a privilege. So Carl was never really clean, since he could only wash like once a week, sometimes once a fortnight, because he was behaving so badly. I will note that the turnover of guards at the reform school was really high, because once people realized what the job entailed, they would leave. So it's scary that there were guards that didn't flinch when they realized what the job entailed, and they continued on, and they were there doing it. Like, that's terrifying. It is also disappointing that the ones who were like, yeah, no thanks, this isn't for me, didn't report what was going on at the school either. So that kind of sucks. Yeah. Now, Carl was stationed to work in the officers' dining rooms, where he washed dishes and waited on tables. But he spent every shift trying to get revenge on the officers, and he did this by urinating in their soups, coffees, and teas, and he even masturbated into the ice cream, which I think is like everyone's fear when they go to a restaurant. I know it's one of mine. He was eventually caught for trying to put rat poison into the school manager's rice pudding and was fired, I suppose, from this work assignment and put onto another. He was punished cruelly, which again, yes, this is bad behavior. You shouldn't pee in someone's soup or jerk off into someone's ice cream. That's no one's touching my fucking ice cream, that's for sure. And yes, so it is bad behavior, but it's a vicious cycle. Like, he's being cruelly punished, so he keeps misbehaving because he's like, well, I hate you all, so I'm gonna continue being bad. I do hope that the guards or anyone who inflicted the pain onto these kids is rotting in hell. But, like, for me, I just want to say to Carl, like, bro, fucking fake it till you make it. Just survive by putting your head down. Keep your mouth shut. Carl was reassigned to the band, but again, he sought revenge. And in 1905, Carl was able to burn down the painting room. The hellhole of a shed was burnt to ashes, which is like, good, yes, because that is a terrible, fucking awful place. But Carl wouldn't have to go in there if he was just behaving. I don't know, like, Carl is such an enigma because he does keep putting himself in positions to receive punishment. But then you hear the punishment, you're like, whoa, 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 whoa. That doesn't really fit the crime. Now, the damage to the building was worth around $3,000, which would be about $100,000 in today's currency. However, Carl never mentioned, nor is there any record of him being caught and punished for the arson, so they didn't actually know that he did it. Now, we don't really know if Carl did it, because we are just taking his word. We don't know if it was a group of boys or whether Carl was part of that, or is Carl taking the credit. I don't know, but he's claiming it. Now, even though the painting room was gone, that didn't mean that the punishments were gone, though. And Carl, if he did burn down the painting room, was feeling a little bit invincible at this point. So he just carried on with misbehaving. He was then given some advice from some older boys to just act like a good boy, and this is exactly what I've just been saying, fake it till you make it. These boys told him to act like he loved Jesus and be good and change his attitude so he can go home. Carl did listen and took this advice, And in 1906, he had like a parole hearing, and he told the board of the school that he wanted to go and learn to be a preacher. He wanted to go to the German Lutheran school and become a member of the clergy. Karl also said that he had learnt from his mistakes. Now, it's believed that after spending 2 years in that hellhole, 14-year-old Karl returned home, reflecting on his time there, and he said, quote, "From the treatment I received and the lessons I've learned, when I left, I knew how I wanted to live my life. I wanted to rob, burn, destroy, and kill everywhere I went and everyone I could as long as I lived." End quote. Oh, Karl. Karl, not cool, my dude. Not cool. When he got home, Matilda and Albert put him straight back to work as if nothing had changed. Like, it doesn't matter that he's been away for 2 years. Straight back to work. But Karl, he wasn't into this. So he tried to find another way to get out of working. And he did this by telling Matilda, his mother, that he wanted to go back to school to be a preacher. And of course, Matilda was so pleased to see her once troublesome child reformed and turning towards her religion. But for Karl, it was just to avoid farm work. He was sent to a German Lutheran school. He learned the German language, was taught Bible history, church history, penmanship, singing. Karl hated every minute. He was teased by the other students. He was given the nickname, Reform School. So Karl just beat them up. Like, oh, this kid, man, he's just violent. Karl, again, was punished and usually spanked by preachers at the school for misbehaving. And once he actually tried to fight back, but the preacher was a lot bigger and stronger, and the preacher was too much for Karl and overpowered him. This was actually another turning point for Karl because he didn't want to be afraid of anyone. And there was an inscription on a Colt revolver that Karl really took to. And it said, quote, "Be not afraid of any man, no matter what his size. When danger threatens, call on me and I will equalize," end quote. Now, the Colt revolver in question here was one that belonged to a fellow classmate. And even though Karl never states how he got the gun from his classmate, he did get it. I don't know if there was some sort of payment or if it was like, give me your lunch money punch kind of thing. Like, give me your gun. Pop. But he got the gun the next day before school, Karl stole one of his brother's vests, tucked the gun into it, and then went off to school. So during a lesson with the one preacher that Karl hated in particular, Karl decided to stir some trouble, which is like, come on, man, like, you don't need to. But he's feeling invincible now at the moment because he had a gun, like he was armed, so he's like, I can do whatever I want. Now when the preacher told him to stand up from his desk, Karl didn't move and even warned the preacher that he was armed. Now obviously thinking that this is all just a big bluff, the preacher grabbed a whip to be more threatening and told Karl to stand up. Again, Karl did not move. The preacher then, like, brought the whip down onto the desk to, like, you know, kind of give him a scare. But it caught the front of Karl's vest, which ripped the buttons off, and the revolver fell out. So now everyone's like, oh, shit. Like, he was being serious. Karl scrambled for the gun while the preacher, like, was in shock because he was telling the truth. Karl stood up and he pulled the trigger twice, but the gun was empty. So Karl just ran away, like, all embarrassed. I can just imagine. Oh, this is so troublesome. Karl ran home, but the school had already been in contact with Matilda. So as soon as Karl got home, guess what? Albert started beating him up and asking him where the gun was, and he wouldn't stop until Karl told him. Now, it's unclear if Karl told Albert the truth or just told him a location to get him off him. But when he did, Albert ran out the front door to find the gun that Karl said, and Carl went out the back door. Later, Carl noted that he wanted to find another gun with the intention of shooting Albert, but he didn't find one. Instead, he ran hard and fast for the railway to catch a train, and this is exactly what 14-year-old Carl Panzram did. He ran away from home, starting his freedom, or so he would have liked it to be. Carl was living as a teenage hobo. He was stowing away on trains, sleeping in boxcars, and hiding in haystacks. Sometimes he rode on the top of the trains, and sometimes he would hold the rods underneath the train, which, like, yeah, no thank you. That is absolutely terrifying. In different towns, Carl would beg for food. Sometimes he worked odd jobs for food, and sometimes he stole from market shops. Like, it wasn't ideal, but for Carl, it was much better than being beaten up every day at home and worked to pure exhaustion by his older brother. So he was learning a lot of life lessons, Carl, and it wasn't long until he learned a really hard one. And just a little trigger warning, this is quite brutal. It involves sexual assault, so just beware. Once Carl tried to befriend four bums that were in a boxcar on a train. Now, Carl never specified anything about these men, but it did sound like they were possibly a little bit older than he was. And these guys, they were like telling he was a nice boy and that they promised they would give him nice things like food and warm clothes and all like basic necessities, really, if Carl had sex with them. Now, Carl was like, no, because yuck. So, allegedly, according to Carl, they ended up gang raping him. He cried and begged for mercy, but none was shown to him. When Carl recounts this, he said that he left the train sadder, sicker, but a wiser boy than when he entered. Now, unfortunately, this wouldn't be the first time that Carl was sexually assaulted. He arrived in a small town out west, begged for food in a stable, but instead was given beer and whiskey, and it wasn't long until he was passed out drunk. When he woke up, even though he thankfully didn't remember the attack, it was clear that he had been sexually assaulted. These two incidences completely changed Carl's outlook on humanity. He looked at everyone with suspicion and hatred and said, quote, "Those were the days that I was learning the lessons that life teaches us all, and they made me what I am today," end quote. Regardless of these two experiences, Carl still continued to travel via train. He kept to himself and didn't let anyone near him. He then arrived in Butte, Montana, and this is still in 1906 at 14 years old. Like, he is a very busy boy, traveling around places and learning to steal and beg and how to get food and learning to survive. But at 14 years old, he was arrested for larceny and he was held in a prison for a month before being sent to another reform school. Now, this experience was not much different than his time at Red Wing, in Minnesota. Carl worked in a shoe shop and out on the fields. He was always trying to escape, but was caught and punished by more whippings and more beatings. There was one guard that Carl hated in particular. This was Officer Bouchard, who was a prize boxer from Boston. Carl felt targeted by him because Officer Bouchard seemed to be the one who was always punishing Carl the most. And to this I say once again, Carl, just keep your head down, keep your mouth shut, and do your time. And then leave. Like, stop causing shit because these people are horrible and you're giving them a reason to do it and it's just... Now, once again, Carl, who seemed to have a pretty obvious issue with authority, would spend time thinking of ways to exact revenge, but now with a more murderous intent. Carl obtained a 2-foot-long wooden board that had about 3 to 4 pounds of iron attached to the end, and while Officer Bouchard was getting his shoe shined, Carl came up behind him and hit him on the top of the skull, which only injured Officer Bouchard and did not kill him, but oh my lord, Carl wish it did, because he was next level punished for this murder attempt. And it was not just by Bouchard once he had recovered from his injuries, but by the other guards, almost treating Carl as like a police killer. You know, when you see criminals who shoot and kill police officers, they seem to be literally hunted down like an animal. You know what I mean? And this is what happened to Carl. Now, everyone in the reform school hated Carl, not just the guards, but the students too. They all thought that he was awful. He was mean. He was a big bully. And even though they were all troublesome kids at the reform school, Carl was next level. They also wanted to send him to the state prison, but now at 15 years old, he was still too young to do that. So the guards continued to beat him instead, and sometimes it'd be for no reason at all, other than his name was Carl Panzram and he had made a murder attempt on Officer Bouchard. Carl, this is a bit weird, Carl also claims that he was circumcised against his will at the reform school because they caught him masturbating too much. But, like, who knows? It could be true. Like, full on could have been, but I don't know. I don't know. After a year at this reform school, so in 1907, Carl actually did make a friend, and this was a boy called Jimmy Benson, who was too smart for his own good. Together, the boys made a plan to escape, and they enacted it. Jimmy escaped first to distract the guards, and Carl ran away after. And it was a success. They did it. They actually escaped. They met up a couple of days later at a water tank in Terry, Montana, after catching a train from Butte, because that would have been about a five-day walk. Carl and Jimmy stuck together and traveled for about a month. Jimmy taught Carl how to commit stick-up robberies and rob the poor boxes at churches, while Carl taught Jimmy how to set fire to a church. He said, quote, "We got busy robbing and burning a church regular," end quote. They played silly pranks out of boredom, such as pouring sand and gravel into trains' axle boxes, which would cause friction on the rods going around, I think. I don't know. I don't really know much about trains, so thank you, Uncle Google, for that quick search. In North Dakota, the boys cut holes in the floors of trains that carried wheat, which caused it to pour out as the train traveled. Like I said, like, these pranks were out of boredom for their own amusement. They also wanted little victories to feel powerful. And as we've seen with Carl, he likes to get a reaction from his behavior. And I think this is a reason why he would play up so much. He loved to get attention, whether it was negative or positive. It was usually quite negative attention, but he loved it nevertheless because it fed his ego. These pranks, like I said, gave the boys a sense of an achievement, assert their masculinity and authority. Plus, we have to remember that Carl is only 15 years old, still going through puberty, has these raging hormones, and because he is constantly in violent places or in violent situations, his testosterone levels would have been through the roof. As he said earlier, he was a human animal since he was born, and now he's only acting on instincts. Through the pair's thieving, they obtained two revolvers, a suit each, and quite a bit of cash and jewelry that they sold before they parted ways in North Dakota. Jimmy decided to go back to Montana, where he was from, so Carl followed suit and he actually went back to Minnesota. But he was there for about 2 days before running away again, carrying on his pattern of behavior of stowing away, stealing, begging, running, fighting, all sorts. Now we're going to fast forward a couple of months till December of 1907, and now a 16-year-old Carl hopped off a train back in Helena in Montana. He went to a saloon where a recruitment officer for the army was there and made a pitch about joining the army. And Carl was really taken with the speech, and I don't really get it because he has a problem with authority. All right, we've seen that. So why would he want to go and join the army where it's all about authority and ranks and hierarchy? I mean, maybe it was the fact that at least he'd have a permanent place, like with food, not always scrapping to find another meal. Perhaps it was the talk of guns and the violence of fighting in a war, but yeah, like, he doesn't like authority or being held to a schedule, so I don't know, that really makes me scratch my head to think why he would be taken in with that pitch. But he was. He lied about his age and he signed up for the army right there and then. And at the end of the day, he was shipped off to join the 6th Infantry Regiment at Fort Harrison in Helena, Montana, along with many other clearly underage runaways and some who had also escaped from reform schools. Now, underage boys were usually overlooked because the minimum age to join was 21, but the army found it really hard to recruit during peacetime in rural areas such as Helena. So he's arrived at Fort Harrison, and it only took Carl an hour to get into trouble. An hour! Like, bloody hell, Carl! And he was sent to the A Company's commander, First Lieutenant George England. He was in trouble because he refused to work. Like, Carl, it's literally a job. You've signed up for a job. You have to fucking work. Like, that's why I don't get it. Maybe he thought, like, he would join and just be given a gun and then, like, off he goes. I don't know. It makes no sense to me. Now, Lieutenant England was a West Point education officer, and he did show patience with Carl. He told him that there was much to be expected of him in the army, and that disobedience resulted in punishment. He even gave Carl a copy of the book, The Art of War, which was all about the rules and punishments of military conduct. Needless to say, Carl was not a fan of the book and the expectations of the army, and while he was in the office with Lieutenant England, he did something to the book. Now, Carl never specified what he did to it, whether he, like, spat on it, ripped it up, or threw it, but he did something really bad to the book, and he was punished by being locked up in the guardhouse for a week. Like, he hadn't even started doing anything in the army, and he was already locked up for a week. 2 days after his release, Carl was reported for fighting and impertinence, and he remained in the guardhouse for another month and was only fed bread and water. Now, at some point, Carl promised that he learned his lesson and that he would be an obedient soldier. Now, does this sound familiar? Like what he did at Red Wing? He was like, yep, yeah, I'll be a good boy. I'll behave. When he really doesn't mean it? Well, yeah, we're going to see that happen a couple of times. Carl shifted his attitude and he got sent back to the A Company. So about a month or two later, on April 8th, 1908, Carl was caught trying to leave his post and he had some stolen goods on his possession. He had two army overcoats, a civilian suit, and a pocket full of gold collar buttons that he intended to sell. 2 days later, 16-year-old Carl was found guilty by a court-martial by a tribunal of four officers, and the Secretary of War at the time was William Howard Taft. If you don't recognize that name, he became the 27th President of the United States in 1909, so the year after. But just before he became President, he was the Secretary of War who sentenced Carl to 3 years in Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. Now, we are going to hold on to William Howard Taft. He will come up again in next week's episode. So a month later, on May 20th, shackled up 16-year-old Carl boarded a train from Fort Harrison, Montana, to Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. And this would be a 19-hour drive today, so it possibly took a day or two to get there. Within the first few days of being at Fort Leavenworth, Carl tried to escape. He also burnt down the prison shops. He's such a creature of habit. Like, his pattern of behavior, his pattern of behavior just repeated over and over and over again. Once again, he got away with burning the prison shop down, just like he alleged that he got away with burning the paint shop down, the painting room down at Red Wing. Carl placed a candle inside a 1 gallon can of oil-soaked rags and put it in the prison shop. Now, during his 1.5 year stay, we'll get to why he didn't serve the full 3 years in a minute, but he worked in a rock quarry in the blistering Kansas sun, breaking rocks all day, but was more often than not getting into trouble again and having many punishments. Now, one of these punishments was that he had to wear a 50-pound iron ball for 6 months at all times, even when he slept. And like that, I don't know, that's kind of like the stereotypical or maybe like cartoon version of like a prison, like in a jumpsuit or like black and white stripes with a ball and chain, like breaking rocks. Like Carl is literally where this came from, because that's what he had to do for 6 months. Even when he slept, he couldn't take it off. Carl said that the work he did by breaking the rocks and wearing the 50-pound chain, at Fort Leavenworth made him into, quote, 190 pounds of concentrated, hell-fired, men-inspired meanness, end quote. Our old mate Carl grew big and he grew very strong. But after 1.5 years, he changed his attitude, managed to convince the prison that he had changed for the better and he wanted to be a good person. There we go. Once again, like he did at Red Wing, like he did in the guardhouse, he's doing it again. Now, obviously, this is like what the goal of prison is, right? Like to deter from recommitting crimes, to change people, to see that the wrongdoings, they shouldn't be, like, you know, that's what they want, right? But the way that Carl was treated was not the way to do it. Like, violence doesn't solve violence. It just lights the fuel. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't think prison should be a good time. I don't think it should be enjoyable. I don't really have any issue with the fact that he's going out there breaking rocks all day. To me, that's like, yeah, hard labor, man. Like, go do it. Like, you fucked up, you go do that. But I think when it comes to the actual torture of, like, the whipping and the unnecessary or over-the-top beatings, it doesn't make someone go, okay, I'll be good, you know? And, yeah, it's so hard because you've got a prisoner, they've done wrong, you want them punished, but I think the humanity within us and whatever level of compassion you have, you don't want to see someone absolutely tortured and whipped to death and beaten up. Like, it's horrible. It is horrible. Prisons, I don't think they should be a good time or enjoyable. I don't think they should have slushy machines in summer, which is something that New Zealand's maximum security prison did a couple of years ago when we had a record hot summer. And everyone was outraged because they got a slushy machine, which means they could have it for free. Whereas I've got to walk down to my local dairy or convenience store and pay like $4. Like, no, thank you. But yeah, like I was just saying, I don't think torture and physical abuse is the way to go to get people to be good either. Some prisons you hear about are too soft and some are far too harsh. The prison system back in Carl's time was unhinged and torturous, and it didn't make Carl want to be good at all. But he didn't want to stay in prison, so once again he tried to fool his way out of prison by making authorities believe that he was a good guy and changed for the better. So in 1910, at 19 years old, Carl was released, and when he left he said that he became, quote, rage personified. All the good that might have been in me was kicked and beaten out of me, end quote. He left with $5, a new set of clothes, and he headed to Colorado, and all that he had in mind at the time was a strong determination to raise plenty of hell with anybody and everybody in any way and every place and every time that he could. He arrived in Denver, Colorado in 1910 and got a job as a mule skinner, and he worked there for a few weeks before being fired. He used his payout money to get a gun, because that's always a good thing to get with your payout money. And he also got very, very drunk. The next day, he woke up in an alley and he had been robbed. His gun was gone, his hat, jacket, and shoes had been taken. Carl also noticed that he had some bumps on his body, like on his head, around his genital region. And he went to the doctors and found out that he had contracted gonorrhea. And he actually never states being intimate with or having an intimate relationship with a woman, but he must have. And the reason I say this is because once he noted down that he was diagnosed with gonorrhea, he said, quote, "I guess women were good to leave alone now," end quote. So I don't know if he was possibly paying for sex workers or worse, he was just taking women when he felt like it, because we will come to find out he's a very, very evil man. But yeah, so I guess he was, I'm not too sure. What I do know, we'll stick to what I do know, is that after Carl left Denver, he robbed churches as he headed east back to Kansas, and he went to a state fair where he got a job as a rider for a show. But again, he was fired for constantly fighting the crew, but he was also abusing the horses and cows by being too physical with them. As he was leaving the state fair, militia soldiers caught him stealing from them, so he quickly skipped Kansas and decided to get the hell out of there, because Carl did not want to go back to prison. He liked to stir trouble, but he didn't like to get caught. So Carl went over a couple of states to Missouri, where he sought to find work at their state fair. But when he was there, he saw the show that he was the rider for back in Kansas, and he just became really angry, really enraged. And allegedly, according to Carl, he set fire to some of their tents and then decided to get out of Dodge once again. Now, we are going to wrap it up here. I know this is kind of like an odd point. It's not really like a cliffhanger or anything. That's fine. But this marks the end of Carl's more tamer crimes. He's a thief. He's an arsonist. He's a brawler. He has attempted to murder a couple of people. He's been incarcerated in one form or another about 4 or 5 times. He has been cruelly treated. He was a shit person as well, who, was a shit to other people and not a very nice person. He did cause a lot of his own troubles, but he did also receive pretty harsh punishment, which led him to make decisions and led him to be the person who he is back at this point, right? And when I say about harsh punishment, I honestly think I'm actually just thinking about when he was 12 and at the reform school, because that's like really hard. It's just the thought of like these little babies who, like, yes, they've been naughty, but like, fuck man, not enough to be whipped. Like I said before, I don't mind the breaking rocks thing because that's just hard labor, but for the time in the reform school, I think that's where I really go, like, that was just too harsh, because he's a kid. And when he's an adult, we're like, well, you need to make your own decisions now. You need to move past, the bad things that happened to you when you were younger, when you had no control, whereas now you have control. So you need to heal and you need to move on and you need to make a better person of yourself. So it's very hard. But it was that time, especially from his time in the reform school and a couple of his other prison incarcerations, that really put Carl on the path of destruction. And from this point onwards, after he left the Missouri State Fair, it just gets a whole lot of bad and a whole lot of ugly. So we are going to put a pin in the story here. Tune in next week to hear all about the bad and the ugly, because it will get bad. We'll see how long next week goes for. We're just over an hour now, so I don't think that's too bad, but we'll see how long next week goes on for, and that will decide whether I do a little bonus episode on the psychology and the aftermath of Carl Panzram, because I do want to talk about it, because I think it is a very important conversation, and it's very fascinating as well. So thank you, lovely listeners, for tuning in. Remember to comment giveaway under this episode on Spotify. Go to Instagram, get some entries in to get some goodies. I will put up another post on Monday tomorrow if you missed it. But until then, be safe, be good, be better, and all that cheesy crap. And I will catch you guys next time for the second part of the Carl Panzram story right here at Coffee and Crime. Happy Easter, everyone. Bye.